Okay, so this is bio 241, and it is Monday, October 13th. We're still in chapter 7, which is neurophysiology, and we talked a little bit about synaptic transmission last time. And so I don't know, what did you learn about synaptic transmission? Anything kind of change your opinion about anything? No, not necessarily. Well, what molecule fuels synaptic transmission? What's the energy source for synaptic transmission? What's the energy molecule that fuels everything in your body pretty much? ATP, it's got to be ATP, right? It's got to be ATP. And so in the axon terminus, there has to be mitochondria that are making ATP, because moving those vesicles around takes energy, takes ATP, fusing with the membrane takes ATP, making neurotransmitter requires ATP. So the nervous system is a highly metabolic organ, requires a lot of ATP. As a matter of fact, just to underscore how much ATP you need, for instance, if we cut off blood supply to the brain, and when blood supply to the brain is cut off, oxygen is not getting to the brain. So what stops when oxygen is not getting to the brain? Yeah, for instance, aerobic respiration stops, right? So anaerobic respiration still continues, but that only produces how many ATP per glucose? Only 2, pretty dismal. All right, so after blood is cut off to the brain, how long can you maintain consciousness? About 3 seconds, and your brain becomes unconscious because you run out of ATP as a result. All right, but ATP is the molecule necessary for life. When does your brain die? When it can't make ATP after 3 minutes, right? So 3 seconds, you're unconscious. 3 minutes, your brain is actually dead. And what does that mean, dead? Can't come back to life. Can't be resuscitated, right? That's an irreversible process. So the nervous system is highly metabolic because of synaptic transmission, requires a lot of ATP to move ions around and vesicles around, to build chemicals. It all requires a lot of energy. Okay, so that's the energy molecule. What's the signaling molecule for synaptic transmission? There's something that's outside the presynaptic cell that enters the Bouton terminale that really kicks synaptic transmission off. What's that signal that gets inside the cell? Okay, ACH stands for acetylcholine. That's a neurotransmitter, right? That's released by the presynaptic cell, but that's, I'm thinking about something that happens way before then. There's a sodium, okay? What's sodium good for? What's sodium good for? For depolarization, that's right, for an action potential. Or maybe a stimulus with a graded potential. All right, so there is an action potential that comes down the axon of the presynaptic neuron. And what is the event that happens right after that? What does that action potential cause in the Bouton terminale? Somebody's reading my mind. That's really good. That causes calcium to enter the cell, right? Calcium, the calcium ion. And so that calcium ion is the signal for the fusion of those synaptic vesicles through those kinases, right? First calcium binds to calmodulin, and then calmodulin activates a protein kinase, which then activates a bunch of other enzymes that causes fusion of the synaptic vesicles. And exocytosis, what's the cell going to exocytose? The neurotransmitter, that's right, the neurotransmitter. So that's synaptic transmission. Then the neurotransmitter moves across the synapse, binds to the postsynaptic membrane. All right, and when the neurotransmitter binds to the postsynaptic membrane, what happens then? What happens then? What does that neurotransmitter actually bind to? Well, you know what? That neurotransmitter actually is a ligand. What does that ligand bind to? A receptor. That's right. And What happens to the receptor when it binds the ligand, or acetylcholine in this case? It changes a conformation. So it's what we call a ligand-gated channel. That channel opens up. In particular, it's specific for sodium. And which way does sodium go? It goes in, and what does that cause on the postsynaptic cell? Yeah, so when sodium goes in, that's always going to be depolarization. So that acts as a stimulus for the postsynaptic cell. So that's what I have to show you on this little video right here. Synaptic transmission, the video. Okay. Oh, wait, maybe if I do this, something will happen. All right, so what do we have? We have a cursor. Good. So here is the presynaptic neuron. Here's the axon terminal. Sometimes we call that the terminal button or Bouton terminale or terminal knob. It's just a swelling at the end of an axon because that end of the axon is filled with these synaptic vesicles. What's inside those synaptic vesicles? Neurotransmitter, right? The other organelle that you don't see on this diagram is producing energy for this process. What would be those organelles? Mitochondria, right? Producing a lot of ATP by aerobic respiration. All right, so an action potential comes down the axon. What are the two main phases of an action potential? The two main phases. Depolarization and repolarization. It's just really as simple as that. And what's depolarization due to? Sodium entering, and repolarization is potassium leaving the cell. So that action potential comes down over here, right? So it depolarizes the membrane, and when it depolarizes the membrane, remember that's changing the voltage across the membrane. And at the axon terminus, there are some other voltage-gated channels besides sodium and potassium. There are calcium voltage-gated channels. And so when the voltage changes, that calcium channel opens up. And where is calcium high concentration? Outside the cell or inside? You had to memorize that in a previous chapter, and you're probably wondering, why do I have to memorize that? Because we need that for synaptic transmission, so calcium then diffuses into this Bouton terminale right here, binds to calmodulin that causes the docking and fusion of these vesicles and the exocytosis of neurotransmitter into, what is this space right here called? That's the synaptic cleft. And then the neurotransmitter diffuses from high concentration to low, low by the postsynaptic membrane. And in the postsynaptic membrane, there are not voltage-gated channels. There are ligand-gated channels. They bind the ligand, namely the neurotransmitter. All right, and when the neurotransmitter binds to this ligand, then they change state from closed to open. Can you see this one is closed because there's no ligand bound to it? This one is open because there's a ligand bound to it. And these are more or less specific for sodium. Some potassium can move through, but it's mostly sodium. And which way is sodium going to move? Where is sodium high? Outside the cell. So sodium is going to enter the postsynaptic cell. And what do we call that? That's depolarization, otherwise known as a stimulus, right? That's going to produce a graded potential on this dendrite or cell body, and that graded potential is going to sweep down to the axon hillock, and if it reaches threshold at the axon hillock of this neuron right here, what's going to start up on the postsynaptic cell? Because when this ligand binds to this ligand-gated channel right here, it doesn't cause an action potential, it just causes a graded potential. And that graded potential is going to move from this dendrite or cell body down to the axon hillock. And if it reaches threshold, what's going to happen? It's going to trigger an action potential on that axon. All right? So that's synaptic transmission. So for synaptic transmission, you should realize that it requires a lot of ATP, so you're going to have a lot of mitochondria in here, but the signaling molecule that enters a cell, what's the name of that signaling molecule that enters a cell? Okay, it's calcium. Calcium is the signaling molecule. All right, so calcium enters the cell, and it binds to calmodulin, and that causes the fusion and docking of these vesicles, release of neurotransmitter. Right, so those two chemicals I definitely want you to become aware of. ATP for what? ATP is good for? Energy. And the calcium is the signal for synaptic transmission, signal for neurotransmitter release. So you got to have both of those in the synapse in order to have synaptic transmission. All right, and I think right before we left last time, we asked, or I asked, where is it more important to have proper calcium levels? In your bones or in the extracellular fluid of your nervous system? What's more important? Having a nervous system that functions properly or bones? Nervous system, because it controls your heart rate, your breathing, all the functions of your body, right? So your body realizes that, and that's one of the reasons why as we get older we lose bone density, because it's maintaining calcium in the extracellular space so that our body can function. All right, so should I click here or are you done with this? Okay, we'll click it. All right, so here's what? Action potential. What does action potential do? Opens up voltage-gated calcium channels. Calcium enters a cell, binds to calmodulin, causes docking of these vesicles, and release a neurotransmitter. Neurotransmitter, right, then causes a conformation change of these ligand-gated channels so sodium can enter the cell. That causes a graded potential. Oh, I can't talk as fast as the video. Right, and that graded potential then sweeps down to the axon hillock of that neuron, and it may or may not cause another action potential. If it's sufficient voltage, if it's a threshold stimulus, then that action potential proceeds down the postsynaptic membrane. The other thing that happens right here is that this neurotransmitter is degraded, because if you release neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft and it never disappeared, what would happen? This postsynaptic membrane would continuously be depolarized, which would continuously cause action potentials. Well, that wouldn't be very handy, because that nerve would be stimulated forever and ever and ever and ever. And that's not how reality is, right? Okay, so let's watch this one more time. Here's that action potential. Triggers voltage-gated calcium channels, which then causes fusion of the synaptic vesicles, release of neurotransmitter, binding of neurotransmitter to the ligand-gated channel, opens them up, causes sodium to depolarize the postsynaptic cell, that causes a graded potential. And then the neurotransmitter is degraded. It goes away. Okay? So you should be, I gave you a list of those steps. So that's just it in motion. All right? Okay. And probably in Blackboard, I'll put this website so that you can see where that is. Okay, well, let's review some our neuroanatomy and relate it to function before we finish up this chapter. So what kind of cell do we see here, this yellow cell? What does that look like? And what's the function of this cell? So it's a neuron of some kind. What kind of neuron is that? That's what we call a unipolar or pseudo-unipolar neuron. Because here's the cell body. Here is a short process which bifurcates into a dendritic process and an axonal process. Now, where do we have neurons of this type? What's the function of this kind of neuron? It's going to be a sensory neuron. What's another name for sensory? Afferent. It's an afferent neuron. So these cell bodies are going to be grouped in the dorsal root ganglia of the spinal cord. Remember, a ganglia is a group of nerve cell bodies someplace in the peripheral nervous system. And let's just say that these are the dendrites over here, and the axon terminus is going to be way over here. This is what we call the peripheral process, because it's in the peripheral nervous system. Enters the dorsal root, and then this goes into the central nervous system, namely the spinal cord. So this is what we call the central process. This is the peripheral process. This is the central process of this sensory neuron right here. Now, what else can you tell me about the speed of conduction on this particular neuron? Is it fast or is it slow? It's fast. How would you characterize that action potential, that nerve impulse? It's saltatory, okay? It's saltatory conduction, because you see What do you see along these, this axis? The myelin sheath. Namely, what kind of cells? Those are what we call Schwann cells. So the function of these Schwann cells is to, what? To allow for saltatory conduction. So this electrical impulse actually jumps from, what are these little spaces between the Schwann cells called again? Nodes of Ranvier. So the electrical impulse hops from one node to the other. What's absent underneath the Schwann cell? There's a certain kind of membrane protein that you're aware of that is absent in that location. Okay, there are no voltage-gated channels in those areas, so that doesn't propagate an action potential. The only places that have voltage-gated channels are the nodes right here. And so that action potential actually hops from node to node down an axon as fast as maybe 300 meters per second. That's pretty fast. If it's a non-myelinated axon, it will transmit an action potential maybe at 1 meter per second. So saltatory conduction is like 300 times faster than regular continuous conduction. All right, so here we have nothing to look at. Now, what's this cell look like? Is that a neuron or a neuroglia? It's neuroglia. It's still nervous tissue. Does it conduct electrical information? No. It's a support cell. It provides for saltatory conduction as well because I see the myelin sheath wrapped around these axons. But now where does it provide for saltatory conduction? What part of the nervous system? Central nervous system, not peripheral. Oligodendrocyte is in the central nervous system. Ah, what's that? Neuroglia or neuron? Neuron. So that means it conducts electrical information. What's the name of that kind of neuron? Multipolar. That's a multipolar neuron. Can you give me some examples of where you might find multipolar neurons? Brain, so like interneurons or association neurons, completely found in the brain are multipolar. And another example that's found half and half, half CNS, half PNS. For instance, motor neurons. Motor neurons are multipolar neurons as well. So neurons that make up an effector pathway to some kind of effector organ, like skeletal muscle, smooth muscle, glands, and cardiac muscle. All right, here's another kind of cell right here, this one right here. Neuron or neuroglia? Neuroglia, right, you know the name? Astrocyte. And what's the job of astrocyte? A number of things. It forms blood-brain barrier, protects your brain. It's also important for what we call neurogenesis, how your brain, as you use your brain, how it reconnects with other neurons and allows you to learn new things. It actually makes you smarter the more you stress your brain. Just like if you stress a muscle, it gets stronger. The more you use your brain, the stronger your brain gets in terms of information processing and making associations. So it's the astrocytes that allow that to happen. And it also specifically takes nutrients from a capillary and delivers it to an axon, for instance, like glucose. It transports glucose directly into a neuron. So if I were to ask a function of that cell right there, the simplest ones would be blood-brain barrier, protects the brain, and neurogenesis. So even though this astrocyte can't cause more neurons to proliferate or to rebuild those that die, it can cause healthy neurons to develop more connections, interconnections between cells. Okay, so that's the job of that astrocyte. This one here, that's easy. Neuron or neuroglia? Neuroglia, what kind of neuroglia? That is a microglia cell. What's the function of a microglial cell? It's for immune response, right? That protects the brain from infection, from tumor genesis, right? It kills tumors and infections. What are these? What's the name of these? Oligodendrocyte. Where do you find them? Central nervous system. What does it provide for? saltatory conduction. Saltatory conduction, is that the fast or the slow? That's the fast one, right? Saltatory conduction. Okay. And these guys right here, it looks like it's lining something. These are the ependymal cells. What are they lining? What is this space right here? This is a ventricle in the brain. So it lines the ventricles, and in some parts of the brain, these cells actually secrete this fluid that goes into the ventricles. What do we call that fluid that goes into the ventricles? CSF, cerebrospinal fluid. So and that tissue that makes cerebrospinal fluid that's made up of these ependymal cells is, everybody knows what that is. Tell me what the name of that tissue is that makes CSF. The choroid plexus in the ventricles makes cerebrospinal fluid. All right. And what's this here? That's a unipolar neuron. It's not microglia, it's a neuron. It conducts action potentials. And I guess I asked you for the name. What is that, unipolar, or sometimes called pseudo-unipolar, because of this single process coming off the cell body and then bifurcating into, this looks like the peripheral process, this looks like the central process here, because it almost looks like I can see some Bhutan terminales right there. It looks like there's a little swelling at the end of that axon. So this would be the central process. This would be the peripheral process. Oh, what's the function of this guy right here? Sensory, right? Sensory. Okay. And what is this? Bipolar neuron. And here I can see, so this is the axon terminals here because I see a little swelling. These are the dendritic processes. And what's the job of this guy right here? The function of a bipolar neuron. It is sensory as well, but very special senses, like for vision, like for vision and smell and hearing, have bipolar neurons, and that's about the only place where we find bipolar neurons. All right, now these bipolar neurons are very small. I would say maybe it's drawn to scale right here, so if this was the axon and this is the dendrite over here, that's about the relative size compared to the cell body. But if we go back, all right, to this bipolar neuron, don't forget, this nerve cell body is in the dorsal root ganglia of the spinal cord. And of course, it's microscopic. You can't see that without a microscope. And this peripheral process is going to go all the way from the spinal cord to where? Like the tip of your fingers. That's hugely long. We wouldn't be able to diagram. If we actually drew out this peripheral process, we wouldn't even be able to see this cell body, right? So this cell is not drawn to scale. So this is a huge cell compared to this bipolar cell right here. All right, but just for the purposes of illustration and talking about it. All right, what do we got here? What kind of neuron? Multipolar. What's the function? Okay, you could say, well, maybe this is in the central nervous system, but there's another clue right here. You wouldn't say central nervous system because why? Because the Schwann cells are in the peripheral nervous system only. So this is a nice motor neuron someplace. The nerve cell bodies and dendrites are in the central nervous system, but this axon is in the peripheral nervous system. All right, and so what kind of conduction is going down this axon? Saltatory, right, 300 meters per second. And this is pretty much where we started. So, I tell you what kind of neuron is that? That's a unipolar neuron. What's the function? Sensory. And what cell is that? Schwann cell. What's the function? It's insulation for saltatory conduction. And anybody know the name of these cells right here? Those are what we call satellite cells. Satellite cells, they're neuroglia as well in the peripheral nervous system. I won't ask you about the function of those. All right, so we went over them one time. Now let's go over them just a little bit faster. What do you say? Yeah, all right. It's more fun. Okay. Oligodendrocyte, where? Central nervous system. What does it provide for? Yeah. But in terms of function, it does insulate. It is an electrical insulator. But, I mean, it affects the timing of the central nervous system, the adaptability of the nervous system, because it provides for saltatory conduction, right? Okay, saltatory conduction. What's that? Multipolar. What kind of functions do they serve? Motor, as well as association neurons in the brain. Okay. Ooh, that was pretty fast. That was an astrocyte. What's the job of the astrocyte? Blood-brain barrier. And? Neurogenesis. I like blood-brain barrier and neurogenesis. Yeah, neurogenesis. Say that again? You know, to some degree, but this is an area of current research, and we're really not sure. For years and years and years, scientists and physicians were totally uninterested in neuroglia because they were interested in neurons because they carry electrical information. But then all of a sudden, we started to learn that there's a lot more things going on in the brain that cannot be explained by neurons. And so now people are starting to particularly look at these neuroglia and trying to figure out exactly what they're doing. And neurogenesis is kind of a new thing that we're learning. We used to think that our brain was after about age 25 and never changed. But you know what? It does change a lot. There is a lot of neurogenesis. The cells don't proliferate. That means the cells that you had 5 years ago are still there, right? Unless they've died or something. And when they die, they don't get replaced. But what is changing is the connection between the cells. So the cells are still in the same place, but as you use your brain, the connections develop and go and reach out and touch more cells that were there all along. Okay, and that gives you additional function and, of course, even more intelligence. The more you use your brain, the more intelligent you get. And when you take a really hard class, like an anatomy class or maybe even a physiology class, is physiology hard? Yeah, okay. Okay, what is happening to your brain? It's actually rebuilding itself due to the function of those astrocytes secreting neurotrophins. And so the brain cells are learning to talk with more brain cells in your brain, and you're actually getting a lot smarter during the class. The brain that you have after the class is not anything like the brain you had before the class, which is pretty interesting, I think. It's actually scary that people would give me their brains to remodel. Okay, but it's happening, whether you believe it or not. Okay. All right, what about the next one here? Oh, that was a microglia. And its function is immune response, protects the brain from infection. Oligodendrocyte provides for saltatory conduction. Where? CNS. Ependymal cells. Are they neurons or neuroglia? Neuroglia. What do? They line the ventricles, and in a few places they make CSF, cerebral spinal fluid. That was a unipolar neuron. What's the function of a unipolar? Sensory. Bipolar, what's its function? Sensory as well, but in only a special organs, like in the eyes and vision. Okay, so for vision, smell, and hearing. Multipolar neuron, and that was a nice motor neuron. What neuroglia did you see around it? Schwann cell, right? What's that? Unipolar neuron for sensory. It's a sensory unipolar neuron. Oligodendrocyte, central nervous system. Okay, well, I think that's good enough. You want to do it one more time really fast? Or? Okay, let's do it one more time. Let's see how fast I can do it. Multipolar neuron. That's right, multipolar for motor. Motor and association. Astrocyte, which is blood-brain barrier or neurogenesis. That's probably my favorite cell right there. Microglia for immune response. Oligodendrocyte for saltatory conduction. Ependymal for Yeah, lining the ventricles and producing CSF. Unipolar neuron. Sensory. Bipolar. Special senses. Multipolar neuron. That's with that, and that's a motor neuron because of the Schwann cells. Unipolar. Oligodendrocyte. Multipolar. Astrocyte. Microglia. Oligodendrocyte. Ependymal. Unipolar. Bipolar. Okay. Yeah, so if you didn't see those flashing before your eyes, you can go back and actually, you should see those. Study them so that you can see the difference between a bipolar cell and a pseudo-unipolar. Those are probably the hardest to recognize. Okay. All right, so we're done with the flash quiz. If we have time after lecture, we can go back and take a look at some of those again. Okay. The PowerPoint slides. Where did we I think we ended right about here last time, pretty much. All right, so relate this to the video that we just saw, right? And so in a synapse, so what the heck is a synapse again? What's a synapse again? It's a structural and, what is it? Yeah, it's a structural and functional unit of communication between what? Between two cells, right? And on this diagram, you see the two cells. But they look really weird because there are these gray boxes, right? So this first gray box is the presynaptic neuron, and the second one is the postsynaptic neuron. So these are the two cells, and what's right in between them? That's a synaptic cleft. So here is a kind of a fancy illustration of the synaptic cleft. So in particular, this is the axon terminus, and what's the receiving end of a neuron? The receiving part of a neuron is dendrites, number one, or cell bodies. We see it right there. So dendrites are cell bodies. Now, why do we call this the receiving end of a neuron? Because what's in the membrane? Special kind of protein. A ligand-gated channel, right? So we got ligand-gated channels up over here, and over here we've got what? Voltage-gated channels in the presynaptic cell. All right, so an action potential's conducted by the axon, and don't forget, what are the two main parts of an action potential? You got depolarization, repolarization, and you got to know what ions are going in what direction. That changes the voltage on the membrane, that opens up that voltage-gated calcium channel, right? And then that binds to calmodulin, causes a cascade of effects inside that synaptic knob, which causes release of neurotransmitter. And we could say excitatory right here, but there might be a circumstance where it releases inhibitory neurotransmitter. We'll look at that a little bit later today. But for this example, let's just say excitatory. If it's excitatory, what's going to be the effect on the postsynaptic membrane? Is it going to cause depolarization or hyperpolarization? What is stimulatory, typically? It is depolarization. How do you depolarize a membrane? You let sodium go inside the cell, right? You let sodium go in. All right, so when the neurotransmitter binds to the ligand-gated channel, it opens that channel for sodium. Sodium diffuses in. That causes an EPSP. Ooh, what does that stand for? Excitatory postsynaptic potential, which means what? If it's excitatory, what happens to the membrane potential? Does it move up to threshold or farther away from threshold? It moves up to threshold, right? Okay, that would be an excitatory postsynaptic potential. That EPSP is a graded potential, and it flows over the dendrites and cell bodies, makes its way to the axon hillock. And if it reaches the axon hillock at a threshold potential, that's going to open both voltage-gated sodium and potassium channels. And that sodium channel, when it opens up, causes what? A depolarization or an action potential at the axon hillock that moves all the way down the axon. So what can you tell me about an action potential at the axon hillock compared to that same action potential when it reaches the end of an axon? Is there any change? What about the height of the voltage change or the width of the action potential? It's the same. That's right. All right, so what do we call that when an action potential moves down an axon and it doesn't change? It is being conducted how? It's being conducted how? Without decrement. Without decrement means there's no change. Even if that axon was a million miles long, even if that axon went out to the moon and back and then out to Pluto and back, the action potential would be exactly the same at the beginning compared to the end. Okay. All right, so that's not an exact figure, but that's a good one. Okay, you should be aware of that. All right, the most widely used neurotransmitter in our body is acetylcholine, abbreviated ACH, capital A, capital C, lowercase h, acetylcholine. It's used in the brain, autonomic nervous system, and at all neuromuscular junctions. Now, it's not working in all synapses in the brain or all parts of the autonomic nervous system, but at every single neuromuscular junction, acetylcholine is the neurotransmitter. Okay. Now, acetylcholine can have different effects in different parts of the body. It can be stimulatory on some organs, and it can be inhibitory on other organs. So how is that possible that one neurotransmitter can have opposite effects in different parts of the body? How can it be excitatory someplace and inhibitory at another? So I don't know if you could answer that question, but that's something that you should think about today. And of course, we're going to talk about why that is. Okay. Well, acetylcholine has two different receptor subtypes. One is called nicotinic and the other is called muscarinic. These are different receptors. Where do we find receptors anyway? In the? In the dendrites, that's right, because they're ligand-gated channels, right, dendrites and cell bodies, but they're in the membrane, right, they're embedded in the membrane, the postsynaptic membrane somehow or another. And we call these nicotinic because they are stimulated, or these kinds of receptors bind another chemical compound that has a similar shape to it, and that's called nicotine. So nicotine has a similar kind of shape to acetylcholine. And there's another subclass, which we call muscarinic, because it binds another kind of chemical. It doesn't bind nicotine because it's not the right shape, but it binds another compound that's found in mushrooms called muscarin. And that is, if you consume any of those kinds of mushrooms, that is extremely toxic and always fatal. Right, that's why they, I don't know if you know, if you all go hunting mushrooms in the forest or whatever, you got to really know. Okay, all silly dwellers, I guess. But anyway, okay, you can't just eat any kind of mushroom because many are just lethally poisonous, right? You have to know which ones you can eat and which ones you can't, because the poisonous ones produce muscarin that bind to these kinds of acetylcholine receptors. And then they'll block them. And it will block synaptic transmission when that happens. Now, some of these receptors can be excitatory or some can be inhibitory. Let's look and see how that happens. But let's just play a little mind game first. What kind of channels would cause excitation if they were to open? And when we say excitation, which kind of channel is going to take RMP up to threshold? It's going to be a sodium channel, right? So excitatory receptors are going to open sodium channels that cause what? The RMP to drift up to threshold voltage. What about inhibitory, ligand-gated? Are they going to cause the voltage RMP to drift up to threshold or actually drift away from threshold? They're going to drift away from threshold. So those would we would call those IPSPs or inhibitory postsynaptic potentials. And what ion would cause RMP to drift away from threshold? Would that still be sodium? Yeah, the best way to explain that is by saying, well, potassium channel opens up and that hyperpolarizes the membrane and it drifts farther away from threshold. That would produce an IPSP. Okay. All right, so ligand-gated channels contain both a neurotransmitter receptor site. How do we explain binding of a neurotransmitter to the receptor site? What kind of model could we have in our mind for explaining how a neurotransmitter is going to bind to a receptor? All right, it's got to be by the shape. So we would use like the lock and key model or the hand and glove model or something that shows that the shape of the ligand has got to be complementary to the shape of the receptor. And if those molecules don't have the right shape, they won't bind. And if binding doesn't happen, then there's not going to be a conformation change in that particular channel. All right, so they contain both a neurotransmitter receptor site and an ion channel. And you can tell me right now, how many different kinds of ion channels could you imagine? At least two. One for sodium, and it's going to be excitatory. One for potassium, and it's going to be inhibitory. Right? And they open when the ligand or that neurotransmitter binds to the receptor. All right, so I'm sure this is an exam figure right here. This is a typical acetylcholine-type receptor of the nicotinic type. What's the other what's the other type?
Muscarinic.
Yeah, muscarinic. Right? So here's nicotinic. So let's just see if the nicotinic receptor is excitatory or inhibitory on effector organs. Here is that protein embedded in the phospholipid bilayer. And this is a relatively complicated kind of protein. It contains five polypeptide subunits that curl back and forth across the membrane. And then as it's curling and folding across the membrane, it has a channel going through it. All right, two of the subunits that are moving across the membrane have receptor sites. So the nicotinic kind of receptor has receptor sites for two acetylcholine molecules. You see one here, right, and one over here. And that's a little unusual. All right, when acetylcholine binds to both of these sites right here, that causes a conformation change, and that opens up the channel because, as a matter of fact, why can't sodium move through the membrane right here, or potassium? Because sodium and potassium are ions. They can't get through this hydrophobic region right here, right? Is that coming back to you? So you have to have this channel that opens up. Both sodium and potassium can move through this channel, but the species that moves the most is sodium, by far. Not so much potassium, but I guess some potassium can leak out. All right, but mostly sodium goes down its concentration gradient from high concentration to low, and the electrical gradient is pulling sodium in the cell. And when sodium enters, what is that producing? That's going to produce an EPSP, excitatory, because that causes a little depolarization. Okay, so that inward flow, inward sodium current causes depolarization, which then sets up a graded potential, which then can flow down to the axon hillock, and that might trigger an action potential at the axon hillock. All right, so this is a typical nicotinic kind of receptor. Two binding sites for acetylcholine, and when it binds, is it excitatory or inhibitory? It's excitatory because the effect is primarily dominated by the transit of sodium ions across the membrane. All right, so that's a nice nicotinic type receptor. Now, what is the ligand in this case? What's the ligand? Ooh, okay, I don't know. Somebody say it out loud, really loud, so I can hear. What's the ligand in this system? Acetylcholine, yeah. Or you could say is what? The neurotransmitter. All right, so the neurotransmitter is acetylcholine. It was such a simple question, you guys freaked or something. Okay, acetylcholine. All right. Well, let's talk about another kind of receptor for acetylcholine. And this is a G-protein coupled receptor. And we've looked at G-protein coupled receptors already before. All right, the neurotransmitter is not part of the ion channel. It's a separate protein in the membrane at some other location in the membrane besides the receptor molecule. And this G-protein coupled receptor is just a really simple one subunit membrane polypeptide. And this is really the oldest kind of receptor that we see in biology. and it's highly conserved. And what that means is that the G-protein coupled receptors that we have in our bodies are very similar, almost identical in composition, amino acid to amino acid composition, as G-protein coupled receptors in most forms of life, like turtles, snakes, okay? What's another really low life form? Like sharks, okay? They have all the same kind of receptors, so it's highly conserved throughout nature. It's a very old, ancient kind of system. All right, this activates an ion channel indirectly through these G proteins. Now, what can you tell me about these G proteins? Can you remember anything about G proteins? They have the ability to do what? To break away from the receptor molecule, disassociate, and do what? Float around on the inner surface of a membrane. Because remember, what's a membrane? A membrane is very fluid in nature, right? It's not just like a tabletop. All right, so here is a really nice example, illustration of a muscarinic-type acetylcholine response. So the binding, in this particular case, of only one acetylcholine, so here's the receptor site, so here's the receptor molecule, it only has to bind one acetylcholine molecule. What about the nicotinic receptor? How many did it have to bind? So that's now a nice difference you could talk about, right? So this just binds one acetylcholine, and coupled to the receptor is the G protein. So, and a G protein is made up of these three subunits, and these will dissociate, and sometimes the alpha subunit will bind to a second protein in the membrane, or sometimes it's the beta and gamma subunit after dissociation will bind to another protein in the membrane, and this protein could be maybe an enzyme, for instance, but what is it in this case, right here? It's a channel, okay? And so when the beta and gamma subunit bind to this protein, and these are what? These are all floating around in the membrane, because it's, remember that fluid mosaic model. When the beta and gamma subunit bind to this channel, it causes it to open up, and it's specific for potassium. So what is that going to produce? Is that going to produce an IPSP or an EPSP? I said it backwards. It's going to produce a IPSP, inhibitory postsynaptic potential, because when potassium leaves the cell, don't forget that causes hyperpolarization. That's going to take RMP farther away from threshold, and that's a graded potential that will flow to the axon hillock, and it will subtract from any EPSPs that reach the axon hillock. All right, so here is this muscarinic receptor is what we call what? Inhibitory, because it's hyperpolarizing. Why is it hyperpolarizing? Because it's opening a potassium channel right here. All right, and then don't forget these beta and gamma subunits recombine with the alpha and go back to this receptor molecule so that this process can repeat itself over and over and over again. All right, so what is the ligand in this kind of system? What's the ligand? Acetylcholine. What was the ligand in this particular case? So it's acetylcholine in both, but it's producing different effects. The nicotinic channel, the nicotinic system is excitatory. This muscarinic is inhibitory. So is it possible for one neurotransmitter to have opposite effects on your body, one stimulatory and one inhibitory? And how would you explain that? Okay, yeah, they're antagonistic. The effect, you know, these are, but what is antagonistic right here? It's only one acetylcholine molecule, but what makes the difference? What makes the difference in response in the cell? It's the same acetylcholine, but it's a different receptor. Okay, so your body can be stimulated into different effects using one neurotransmitter because different parts of your body might have different receptors. Okay, so acetylcholine could be excitatory in some regions of your body and inhibitory in other regions of your body at the exact same time because there are different receptors in the membrane. So that's typically how we would answer a question like that. But not just for acetylcholine, but for other kinds of neurotransmitters as well, like, for instance, norepinephrine. Okay, we're going to look at some of those. All right, so how is it that once acetylcholine is released into the synaptic cleft, that it doesn't exert its effects on the postsynaptic cell forever and ever and ever and ever? That it doesn't always, from then on, for the rest of your life, doesn't produce EPSPs or IPSPs at that particular synapse? And that's because acetylcholine has a short lifetime in the synapse. So how is it that something has a short lifetime? What has to happen to it? It's got to be taken out of the synapse, or it's got to be broken down. And so there are enzymes in the synapse on the postsynaptic membrane right here. So let's focus into this. So you see the presynaptic cell and the postsynaptic cell right here. And this kind of looks like a G protein coupled receptor. All right, and acetylcholine can bind to an enzyme. And again, you would explain binding of acetylcholine to this enzyme. This active site has to have what? A complementary shape to it in order for it to bind. Well, this enzyme is going to break acetylcholine down into acetate and to choline. And you kind of know what acetate is. What is acetate? How many carbons does acetate have? You thought you had to forget all that. Right. Like an acetyl group is a two-carbon unit, right? It's a part of aerobic respiration, you know, but here it's being used for a part of it for a neurotransmitter. All right, so it's broken down, and then acetate will be taken back up by the cell and then reincorporated into with a choline to make acetylcholine again. And when acetylcholine is broken down into acetate and choline, then it can no longer stimulate this receptor right here because it doesn't have the right shape anymore. So that limits the effect of acetylcholine in the synaptic cleft. The enzyme right here that breaks down acetylcholine is called acetylcholinesterase. And you know that's an enzyme, why? Because there's an ASE on the end of that word right there. And the substrate is right there, acetylcholine. All right, and ACE means it breaks down acetylcholine. So that limits the effect of acetylcholine as a ligand, right, to the system right here. So when it gets broken down, that terminates its action. Right? And that enzyme is located in the synaptic cleft. All right, let's look at some other neurotransmitters. Unless somebody's got a question. Anybody got a question so far? All right, so how is it that one neurotransmitter, like acetylcholine, can be excitatory in some parts of your body and inhibitory in other parts of your body? Because of different receptors. Like, give me the name of two kinds of receptors that now that you know about for acetylcholine. Yeah, you got nicotinic and muscarinic. And nicotinic is pretty much always stimulatory. Muscarinic can be one of two kinds, can be stimulatory or inhibitory. But we look at an inhibitory case in this example right here. All right, other kinds of neurotransmitters. All right, let's finish some thoughts up with acetylcholine in the peripheral nervous system. So not in the central nervous system, but peripheral nervous system. When acetylcholine is used as a system of communication between cells, that means acetylcholine is a ligand, and there's going to either be a nicotinic or muscarinic receptor on the postsynaptic cell, we say that that system is cholinergic. They're a cholinergic neuron, or the synapse is cholinergic if it uses acetylcholine. All right, the large synapses on skeletal muscle are what we call end plates or neuromuscular junctions. And this is kind of different from the synapse that we were talking about because when acetylcholine binds to nicotinic receptors, all receptors in skeletal muscle are nicotinic in nature. So what does that mean? They're all excitatory, right? Whenever there is an action potential reaching the axon terminus to a muscle fiber, it releases so much acetylcholine that it always causes muscle contraction. So there's never a case, if it's a healthy muscle and a healthy neuron, that a motor signal can come down an axon and the muscle won't contract. Because what kind of control do you have over skeletal muscle? It's voluntary control. That means you're controlling that. The muscle should never decide for itself whether it should contract or not. When it gets a signal to contract, what does it do? It just contracts. Because there's so much acetylcholine released, it's always going to cause a threshold potential at the neuromuscular junction. All right, so there's no logic for muscle. It's just listening for commands from your brain. So it produces large EPSPs called end plate potentials that opens voltage-gated channels beneath the end plate, and that causes muscle contraction in every single case, as long as it's not a fatigued muscle or a damaged muscle. Muscle can't ever decide for itself whether it should contract or not. Now, there is a chemical that can bind to the nicotinic receptor in the neuromuscular junction. And this is sort of interesting because this has been known for thousands of years. So there is a chemical, all right, that's similar to acetylcholine that's going to bind to this active site on a nicotinic receptor. And when it binds, it doesn't cause this channel to open. And if that chemical is in binding to the receptor, what about acetylcholine? Can it get in there and bind as well? It can't. So this is one of the criteria for active sites, and that is competition. Okay? So if there is a similarly shaped molecule that can bind, it's going to compete for that binding site, and the name of that compound is called curare. It will block the action of acetylcholine. Now, how does that sound to you? Is kind of a benign chemical or a really dangerous kind of chemical? What would happen to you if all of your nicotinic receptors got blocked, if they couldn't operate? What would happen to you? What couldn't you use? Your muscles, your skeletal muscles, right? All right, so that was actually used by the Aboriginal peoples in South America for thousands of years because they knew where to find this curare molecule. That's found on the slime of certain frogs, tree frogs, in South America, in the tropical rainforests. So the frogs would produce this, which is a toxin, so animals would learn not to eat these little frogs because they'd die if they ever ate the frogs. Right? And so these are what we call, they come from the really pretty, brightly colored tree frogs, which are called, what, poison dart frogs or poison arrow frogs. So the people down there would catch a frog and be really careful with it, of course, not eat it or anything. Take a little dart or arrow and slurp up some of the slime off of that frog, right? And then they could go hunting like big buffalo or something and shoot this little tiny arrow into this huge animal that would inject the curare, and that would poison the neuromuscular junctions of this huge animal, and then, you know, everybody could party for a couple of weeks because they had plenty of food. Marvelous thing. Now, not everybody could carry these arrows around because, why? You wouldn't want to give them to like a 12-year-old. No, right? You had to be really educated to use these things carefully. So typically what would happen, curare first would block the action of the diaphragm. What's a diaphragm necessary for? Breathing, yeah. How long could that water buffalo or whatever maintain consciousness? Yeah, not very long, right? So then you can just walk over, pick them up, and there you go. All right, so... So that was really one of the first examples of the pharmaceutical basis of using receptors and neurotransmitters, all right, for the benefit of mankind. Okay. Other kinds of neurotransmitters include serotonin. All right, these are all monoamine neurotransmitters. Include serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. Serotonin is derived from tryptophan. Now, we don't study much in the way of these kinds of compounds, but I think I want to point it out to you. Does anybody know what tryptophan is? Maybe we talked about it in passing. Tryptophan is a building block for proteins. What's a building block of protein called? Amino acid. So tryptophan is an amino acid. And in particular, there are two general classes of amino acids. There are amino acids that your body can make, and then there are amino acids that your body cannot make. Does anybody know what those amino acids are that your body can't make, what they're called? They're essential amino acids. So if your body can't make them, where do you have to get them from? Your diet. You got to eat them, right? And if you don't eat the right amino acids, you're going to have a deficit in your body for whatever protein is being made that needs that amino acid, all right? And so tryptophan is an essential amino acid. If you don't have tryptophan in your diet, what can't you make? Serotonin. And that's a really important neurotransmitter. right? So diet will affect how our nervous system functions because our diet contains precursors of certain neurotransmitters like we see right here, serotonin. Okay. And norepinephrine and dopamine are derived from a different amino acid called tyrosine. And you know what? Tyrosine shares some similarities to tryptophan in that it is an essential amino acid as well. Right, so unless you have the proper diet, you can't synthesize serotonin, can't synthesize norepinephrine or dopamine, which are crucial neurotransmitters in the central nervous system. And where do we get these amino acids from? Our diet, but what part of our diet in particular? Right, from meat proteins, not from vegetable proteins, unless you're really smart on how you develop your vegetarian lifestyle. You have to combine vegetables in the right way to get all of the correct amino acids, right? You have to eat rice and beans in the same meal, the same day, in order for that to happen. Okay. Well, nonetheless, all of these right here, norepinephrine and dopamine, are what we call catecholamines. Okay, so let's look at a synapse that involves not acetylcholine, but catecholamines instead. So I think you can see some similarities. Here is a synaptic knob, and you can see neurotransmitter and synaptic vesicles. And you can see that calcium, an influx of calcium into synaptic knob is necessary for docking and fusion of the vesicles and exocytosis of these neurotransmitters. Right, and it's that action potential that causes these calcium channels to open up. Right, and then they're going to diffuse across the synaptic cleft, bind to a receptor. All right, so this is what kind of channel is this? This is a ligand-gated channel, right? A ligand-gated channel that opens up, like a sodium channel causes an EPSP. All right, but now instead of norepinephrine being broken down by enzymes in the synaptic cleft, all right, norepinephrine is actually pumped back into the presynaptic nerve ending right here. All right, so there are reuptake pumps that pump it into the cytoplasm of the presynaptic neuron, and there it's degraded. And the chemical compound that degrades norepinephrine is monoamine oxidase, or MAO. All right, so one of the theories that explains depression or the biological basis for clinical depression involves the neurotransmitter norepinephrine. A person that is experiencing clinical depression does not have enough norepinephrine to stimulate this postsynaptic cell. So how will we help somebody that is not making enough norepinephrine? Okay, two different ways. All right, if we don't affect the reuptake, taking it away from the synaptic cleft, we just won't break it down once it gets into the cell. Right, so MAO inhibitors are a way to potentiate the effects of norepinephrine, because then that norepinephrine gets reincorporated into synaptic vesicles. So when these vesicles fuse with the membrane, more norepinephrine is released because it's not broken down inside the cell, which means more epinephrine can bind to these ligand-gated channels, which then has a greater effect to produce an EPSP on the postsynaptic membrane. So that's one particular way of doing that, right? By inhibiting monoamine oxidase. Okay, so what about monoamine neurotransmitters and the receptors? These are G-protein coupled receptors, right? So these are more like what? These are more like the nicotinic type receptors or the muscarinic type receptors? They're more like the muscarinic type receptors. So here we have one single molecule of norepinephrine binding to a receptor that's going to activate the G-protein, and in this particular case, the alpha subunit is going to bump into a protein, but in this particular case, it's not a channel. Do you see a channel right here? No channel. All right, we call this adenylate cyclase. So what kind of molecule is this with an ASE on the end of it? That's right, it's an enzyme. So it's going to catalyze a reaction once it becomes activated by this alpha subunit right here. And the reaction that it catalyzes is the conversion of ATP, which is an important energy molecule, into cyclic AMP. All right, so what does this M right here stand for? What does that mean? Monophosphate. So ATP, which has three phosphates, is converted into one that just has a molecule that just has one phosphate, and the other two phosphates go running around in the cell someplace. But a particular kind of molecule is formed. It's called cyclic AMP. So it's a AMP, which has one phosphate, but it forms a ring structure. So it has a very particular shape because now it's a ring. It has a very particular shape. And cyclic AMP then can convert a protein kinase from an inactive form into an active form. What does a protein kinase do? Or what does a kinase do? It adds a phosphorus to some other kind of protein, maybe an enzyme. And when you add a phosphorus to an enzyme, it's like jabbing it with your finger. Okay, it's going to change conformation. It can activate an enzyme. All right, so now we have an active protein kinase, and it can open other channels in the membrane, all right, which then can be excitatory or inhibitory depending on what the channel is, whether it's a sodium channel or a potassium channel. All right, so what do we have right here? So we have a signaling molecule, norepinephrine. Now, does norepinephrine ever get inside the cell? It's outside the cell, right? So it binds to a receptor on the outside of the cell, never gets inside the cell. But through this action right here, incorporating adenylate cyclase, it causes another signaling molecule to be built up where? Inside the cell, and that's what we call cyclic AMP. Okay, and then cyclic AMP acts as a signal to open this channel right here. So I actually see two messengers in this particular system. The first messenger is always found outside the cell, and that's going to be norepinephrine. There is one messenger that's going to be inside the cell, that is cyclic AMP. And I think maybe in one of the chapters previously we talked about first messengers and second messengers. First messengers we always find outside the cell. Second messengers we find inside the cell. Okay, so cyclic AMP is what we call a second messenger system, and it's produced by what? This adenylate cyclase, and I think you had to know the name of this enzyme for the test last time. It was just one of the names of enzymes that you had to know, like carbonic anhydrase was in that list. All right, it catalyzes the conversion of ATP into this second messenger, okay, which then opens this protein channel. Well, what can you tell me about this adenylate cyclase when it catalyzes this reaction right here? Does adenylate cyclase get used up when it converts ATP to cyclic AMP? It does not, because it's just an enzyme. So how many cyclic AMPs can be produced when this adenylate cyclase is activated? Thousands, maybe tens of thousands. Okay? So here we have thousands or tens of thousands of cyclic AMPs, second messengers inside the cell, but how many messengers do we have outside the cell? We got one. So is that amazing or what? You have one signal outside the cell, and it's converted into what? Thousands of signals inside the cell. What do we call that on your radio? That's what we call amplification, right? When you turn the volume up, that's amplification. So this kind of second messenger system is characterized by amplification. It can take a really small signal outside the cell and convert it into a huge signal inside the cell via amplification because of that. So that's one of the beauties of a G protein coupled reaction. And it's a cascade because why? Here's one step, here's another step, here's a third step. And at each one of these steps, there is a level of amplification that takes place. So it's not just amplified one time, it's amplified what? One, two, three times. So a very small signaling molecule can have what kind of response inside the cell? Can have a huge response inside the cell because of a cascade mechanism and amplification. So that's pretty interesting. Now, when you have a signal outside the cell and it gets converted into a signal inside the cell, we call that something. All right, when it moves across, it doesn't have to diffuse into the cell, but it can work through this G protein couple. We call this, right? Signal transduction. Signal transduction. And one of the best ways for signal transduction is to use a G protein coupled kind of mechanism that employs amplification and a cascade to produce a huge effect, metabolic effect inside the cell. Okay, so I'm going to stop for a second. I'm going to look at my watch. We're not done yet for today. Well, we're almost done. We got 10 minutes left. Okay. But does anybody have any questions before I keep steamrolling through all this stuff? Yes.
Just a question about long-term.
Yeah.
What about shivering? Is that a chemical?
Oh, okay. Okay. The hypothalamus kind of injects a signal into your somatic nervous system, and it overrides your conscious control of skeletal muscle. It's well, the nerve signal is going to be electrical, so the hypothalamus contributes to motor outflow or efferent fibers that are going to skeletal muscle. Okay. Yeah, and you can't really control that. So if you're really, really cold, you're going to shiver no matter what, even though it's what we call voluntary muscle. There are some analogies that work in reverse of that. There are some organs that you don't have control over, like your heart. But for instance, if I was going to say, how about if we get test 3 over with today? Just put your books away. Let's just take it right now. Okay? What happens to your heart rate? It just went up, even though it's under voluntary. So there are ways that everything in your body interacts with each other. And we're just learning some of the standard ways. Right? But higher centers in the brain can control other functions that might be involuntary or voluntary in different ways, depending on the circumstances. Okay. And the shivering is what we call a reflex. So that's something you really can't control with thought very much. I suppose maybe there's a yoga master someplace that can freeze themselves down to the point where you would shiver uncontrollably and they can control it, but I'm not sure how that really happens. Okay, well, let's look at just a couple more slides. Serotonin. All right, what does serotonin need? In order for you to make serotonin, it needs an essential amino acid, all right, yeah, tryptophan. It's involved in regulation of mood, behavior, appetite, and cerebral circulation, right? LSD is structurally similar. Do you guys know what LSD is anymore? Probably not, huh? Okay, it's a hallucinogenic that used to be really popular, I think, in the 60s. One way to potentiate the effects of serotonin is to use serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors. Remember, one way that some catecholamines, or that actually all catecholamines, are taken out of the synaptic cleft and reduce their activity is to what? Have them be removed from the synapse by some kind of pump. Well, here are some drugs like Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, and Luvox. They block the reuptake of serotonin. So if it blocks the reuptake of serotonin, where does it extend its lifetime? In the synaptic cleft, so that it can bind over and over again to those receptors and potentiate the effects of serotonin. Okay, so these guys right here are reuptake inhibitors, prolonging the action of serotonin. All right, but again, if you don't have the right precursors in your diet, right, then you're going to be predisposed to what kind of condition? Yeah, so depression can be caused by improper diet, which I think is, so here's a nice molecular example of that. Dopamine, there are two major dopamine systems in the brain. The nigrosubstantial dopamine system originates in the substantia nigra, that's a basal nuclei, and that's involved in motor control. Degeneration of the system causes Parkinson's disease. What does Parkinson's disease look like? You have tremor, you have muscle rigidity, and it kind of gives you the impression that somebody is intoxicated. I mean, their mental function is completely normal, their system of thinking is completely rational, they're not intoxicated, but their gait is disturbed and their motor coordination is disturbed. And a lot of times, if you don't know that somebody has Parkinson's disease and you just meet them, you think that they are drunk, which is in most everyday circumstances. Like if I were to show up and lecture completely drunk, it would be what?
Funny.
It would be funny, but it would be inappropriate, right? It certainly would be inappropriate, and usually we don't like to hang around with inappropriate people. Okay, so if you so that's something that you have to guard against in your clinical life. You might run into somebody and they might look like they're intoxicated and acting what? Inappropriately, and you might kind of shun them, but what might be the real underlying cause? They might have Parkinson's disease, right? So don't ever treat somebody with Parkinson's disease like they're an alcoholic or inappropriately abusing alcohol, because some of the outward symptoms might look exactly the same. Okay, and you'll lose the respect of some of those people, definitely. Parkinson's disease usually has an old onset. Usually it's when somebody becomes older, but it can also be produced by trauma to the brain, in particular the basal nuclei. So there's a sporting event that produces a lot of trauma to the brain, typically. And there's a very famous person that had an early onset of Parkinson's disease. So who's that? That's Muhammad Ali, right? Because he gets slammed in the head by these incredibly powerful boxers that damage his basal nuclei. And so now whenever he's in public, he looks like he's what? Intoxicated, but he's not. He's got what? Parkinson's disease. So his cognitive function is fine. It's perfect, right? It's just his motor coordination has really been destroyed because of boxing. Okay, this system can also be destroyed by other kinds of ligands. And this is sort of an interesting story, and then I'll stop after the story, I think. And maybe you should do a little Google search on frozen addicts sometime. And frozen addicts, this was reported on 60 Minutes probably about 15, 20 years ago, way before you guys were really conscious of this kind of stuff. But there was a batch of heroin that was produced in Britain, and so there were some addicts that were using heroin. And there were some analogs to heroin in this batch that bound to receptors in the basal nuclei and irreversibly bound to those receptors. So what happened to these receptors when they were irreversibly bound to these contaminants in heroin? You could say heroin is a contaminant in your body, but anyway, those receptors were what? Were wiped out. And it's necessary for those receptors for you to have what? Normal body motion. And those addicts actually became frozen. They lost all voluntary control of their body. They were just completely frozen. But what about their cognitive ability, their thinking ability? Completely not affected. So they had absolutely normal lives internally. They just couldn't do what? They couldn't interact with their environment. Couldn't eat, couldn't talk. Okay? Really kind of a sad circumstance. So be careful with any kind of recreational pharmaceutical use, right? Because it can have devastating effects on your central nervous system because of the specificity of pharmacologic agents to what? What's in the membrane? Receptors, right? Okay, so that produced an early onset of Parkinson's disease, and you might know another very famous actor that has an early onset of Parkinson's disease. Michael J. Fox. And he was an outstanding Canadian citizen and was asked, well, did you ever abuse drugs when you were growing up? Because that's usually what early onset Parkinson's is attributed to if it's not trauma. And he said no, because us Canadians just don't do that kind of stuff. And, of course, we all believe him. And there actually were a number of child actors from the set Family Ties that came down with early onset Parkinson's disease. And so now everybody thinks that all those children that were acting on that one set had like some punch or something spiked with amphetamine-like drugs to get them up, because filming takes place over long extended periods of time, and a lot of people got hurt because of that. So that's kind of interesting as well. All right, so that just kind of underscores the importance of ligands and receptors. And why is it that one neurotransmitter can have opposite effects in the body? It can have different kinds of receptors. And so you know what that means? That means we got to learn more about different kinds of receptors in this class. Okay.